Thank you, and good morning. In 1987, when I was chair of Black Studies at Ohio State University, I decided to write a modest political biography of the African-American leader Malcolm X. I was already well acquainted with the Malcolm X story, or so I then thought. I began my work with a survey of the already published literature. By the mid-1980s, there was already a substantial body of work about Malcolm X available, including over 250 scholarly articles and about 100 books. By 2003, in comparison, the entire corpus of Malcolm X literature would encompass more than 950 books and periodical articles, 240 films and web-based educational resources, and 250 sound recordings. Nearly everyone who had written about Malcolm X, largely with remarkable exceptions, accepted as fact much, if not all, of the chronology of events and personal experiences depicted in the 1965 book, The Autobiography of Malcolm X, co-authored by Malcolm X and journalist Alex Haley, who subsequently authored the best-selling Roots. No one questioned or even double-checked the edited published transcripts of Malcolm's speeches as presented in Malcolm X Speaks and the book By Any Means Necessary against the actual tape recordings of those speeches or the transcribed excerpts of the same talks recorded by the FBI. Comparing the actual tape recordings with the transcripts, my research discovered important omissions and deletions from the transcribed speeches of Malcolm X, even one half of his most famous public speech, Message to the Grassroots, is entirely missing from the published book. Even every biographer knows that memoirs like Malcolm's autobiography are inherently biased. They present a representation of the subject that privileges certain facts while self-censoring others. There are deliberate omissions, the chronological reordering of events, and name changes. And yet when I discuss these apparent research problems with colleagues, at least at Columbia University, some reacted with surprise. They said, well, wasn't the autobiography of Malcolm X the official testament to the life and times of this controversial African-American leader? Why devote years of your professional life to writing another biography of Malcolm X? Well, over the last 20 years of research, I've discovered why a truly complete biography of Malcolm X has never been done. And the reasons are far more complicated and revealing of Black and American culture than are immediately apparent. And I came to see that not only did the autobiography offer a biased version of the story, devoid of a larger historical context, but the man himself, the real Malcolm X, was infinitely more remarkable than the personality he presented in his own narrative. Throughout his entire life, Malcolm X lived behind a tightly controlled public persona. He continuously and astutely refashioned his outward image, redesigning his public style and even language to achieve his political purpose. One would say he was the first to contribute to the myth that would be built around him. After his death, memoirs and articles by followers and friends, many of them rife with embellishments and sympathetic distortion, further clouded the historical record. Divergent political groups, from the Black Panthers to the Black Cultural Nationalist to the Trotskyist Socialist Workers' Party, seized upon the figure of Malcolm X as a representative of their own ideas, each emphasizing a different philosophical moment in his career to advance their own agendas. Gradually, the gap between the public telling of the story and the actual record of events widened. By the late 1990s, Malcolm X, in the eyes of the general public, metamorphs from militant Black leader to mainstream American idol. A rediscovery of Malcolm, therefore, begins by pulling away the many layers of honorific distortion, getting behind the scenes of events and determining what actually occurred. I try to, in this book project, present facts that Malcolm himself did not know, the full weight of FBI surveillance used against him, including their penetration of the Nation of Islam, or NOI, at the highest levels, the influence of Alex Haley's personal agenda on the contents of the autobiography of Malcolm X, the men in Malcolm X's intimate coterie who may have actively participated in his murder, the true motive behind the Nation of Islam's homicidal actions against him, the New York District Attorney's suppression of key evidence in the 1966 murder trial, as well as possible collaboration of the New York Police Department in the assassination itself. Central to this laborious process of historical reconstruction has been the methodology of oral history. Since 2002, I have interviewed members of Malcolm's coterie of associates, prominent artists and public figures close to Malcolm X, such as the late Ossie Davis, as well as past and current members of the Nation of Islam. Throughout this process of interrogation, I have endeavored to separate the multiple myths surrounding Malcolm X from fact, which requires an explanation for how the popular embellishments and distortions of this powerful personality occurred. Because without knowing the myths and their origins, we will never know the real man, and without knowing the man, we will never know the full truth. After years of painstaking research and fact-checking, it became abundantly clear that in order to write a full-length biography of Malcolm, I had to deconstruct the Alex Haley mythology of the autobiography. On issue after issue, I've discovered that much of the Malcolm X narrative that everybody knows is grossly oversimplistic, and a good deal of it is just plain wrong. The necessary historical rewriting must begin with Malcolm's father, Earl Little, an itinerant, unordained preacher and black nationalist who was not murdered by white racists, but died in a fatal streetcar accident when he tragically slipped and fell attempting to board, and the car ran over his legs. Malcolm's mother, Louise Little, had suffered from severe depression precipitated by an out-of-wedlock child following her husband's death and leading to her institutionalization in a mental hospital. The young Malcolm Little's celebrated gangster career as Detroit Red in the 40s is largely fictive, based on a review of the actual criminal history of Malcolm. From almost the beginning of his membership of the Nation of Islam, from 1952 to 64, Malcolm X continuously violated the group's practices and provocatively challenged the established conservative leadership. He then presented very different political personas to divergent constituencies and audiences at different times based on a close reading of new transcripts of his actual speeches during these years. By 64-65, with his break from the NOI's racial separatism, Malcolm's popularity increased among thousands of African Americans who were mesmerized by his charisma and militant message of black pride and revolutionary nationalism. Yet from oral history interviews conducted with Malcolm's associates, Herman Ferguson and Peter Bailey, who were in the Organization of Afro-American Unity, I've learned that Malcolm's actual core followers, his real core, in these two groups, the Organization of Afro-American Unity and Muslim Mosque Incorporated, amounted to barely 100 people. There were sharp conflicts between these two groups, and many Muslims who had defected from the NOI in solidarity with Malcolm, who joined Muslim Mosque Incorporated, soon quit within several months, angered and outraged over Malcolm's new emphasis on interracial cooperation and his growing support for women's equality and women's participation in political leadership. That they could not stand. Malcolm X's final version of self-representation, El Haj Malik El Shabazz, was undoubtedly a product of a profoundly emotional, sincere conversion experience. But it was also necessary strategically to reposition his public presentation, which permitted him to claim access and leadership within the existing civil rights movement, which by 1964-65 was beginning to shift its focus from the rural South to the urban North. A renunciation of anti-white racism was also politically necessary and financially necessary for Malcolm to develop cordial relations with the governments of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Algeria. These are the facts, not fantasy. Most previous books on Malcolm's life, including the autobiography, make the mistake of focusing almost exclusively on the subject's powerful, charismatic personality, saying relatively little to nothing about the inner life of the primary organization he labored so hard to build, the Nation of Islam. As a result, most writers have uncritically accepted Malcolm's public explanations from 1964-65 and the arguments critical of the NOI presented in the autobiography that the celebrity status and publicity surrounding the, as Ossie put it, the black shining prince, generated jealousy and resentment within the cult organization, culminating in the leader Elijah Muhammad's decision to silence his lieutenant and later to physically eliminate him. Here again, the real story, based on my interviews with NOI members, including Louis Farrakhan and Robert 15X Johnson, one of the men convicted in 1966 of murdering Malcolm X, and who served over 25 years in prison, is far more complicated. Telling the full uncensored story of Malcolm, I slowly began to understand, would require a 360-degree comprehensive approach, carefully shifting through controversial issues and major events, weighing evidence from all sides, even listening to individuals like Farrakhan, with whom I have fundamental disagreements. Fairness and objectivity, nevertheless, has required me to solicit details explaining the NOI's quote-unquote justification for its brutal actions and campaign of harassment and violence against Malcolm and his family, in order to piece together the essential facts explaining the causes behind his murder. In this effort, oral history methodology has been absolutely critical. By identifying key followers and enemies of Malcolm and documenting their life histories, I have begun to piece together critical new evidence about important events that contribute to a strikingly different interpretation of this American icon. What made Malcolm X truly original and unique among all other major black leaders throughout U.S. history? And this includes Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, Du Bois, Martin, and even Jesse, was that he represented himself as the dynamic embodiment of two central figures of African-American folk culture, drawn from several centuries of oral literature. Malcolm X was simultaneously the hustler trickster and the preacher minister, Janus-faced in the black popular imagination. The trickster is unpredictable, capable of outrageous transgressions. The minister saves souls, redeems shattered lives, and promises a new world to come. Malcolm X was a careful student of black folk culture, and his constant use of animal stories, rural metaphors, and trickster tales. For example, in 1964, most famously, The Fox and the Wolf, presented as Lyndon Johnson and Barry Goldwater, respectively. in the 1964 presidential campaign illustrates this. His speeches mesmerized audiences because he brilliantly orchestrated all of these themes seamlessly in a black militant narrative that promised deliverance. It was through his dynamic performances on stage that all these complex elements of black folk culture, personal history, and NOI ideology were vividly expressed through the actions of a single, powerfully masculinist figure. I have to move the story forward a bit because we only have limited time. At the site of the assassination, police arrested an NOI member, 22-year-old Talmadge Hare, as one of the killers of Malcolm X. On February the 26, 1965, NOI member Norman 3X Butler was arrested by police as a suspect in the Malcolm X murder. A third prominent NOI member, Thomas 15X Johnson, was soon arrested for the killing as well. All of the Muslim Mosque Incorporated and OAAU leaders who had once belonged to the Nation of Islam were quite familiar with both Butler and Johnson. Had either of these men entered the ballroom that afternoon prior to Malcolm's address, they would have been identified, immediately confronted, and firmly escorted out. Butler especially had a violent reputation as an enforcer for Elijah Muhammad. Whether due to grief or suspicion, Malcolm's followers decided to say nothing at the trial or to the NYPD or to the DA. This was a tragic mistake. In 1966, Johnson and Butler were found guilty of the murder of Malcolm X. They received sentences of life imprisonment. Throughout the trial, both Johnson and Butler steadfastly denied any involvement or participation in the shooting. Keep in mind, only Hare was arrested at the scene of the crime. 11 years later, in 1977, Hare confessed to a Muslim clergyman inside prison that he had lied about Johnson's and Butler's participation in the crime. The assassination, he explained, had been extremely well orchestrated and carefully planned. Six men, not three, had actually participated in the murder. Indeed, the evening before Malcolm's assassination, Hare and others had been inside the Audubon Ballroom, spending over 1 hour walking through the logistics of the murder that was carried out the next day. On the strength of Hare's startling revelation, civil rights attorney William Kunstler sought to reopen the cases of Butler and Johnson. In 1978, Bill Kunstler's appeal for a new trial was summarily rejected by New York Judge Harold Rothway, who ruled that there was insufficient evidence to warrant a second trial. The County of New York's district attorney concurred with Rothway's decision. The case was closed. Thomas Johnson, Norman Butler, and Talmadge Hare were all released from New York State prisons in the 1990s. To reconstruct their stories about Malcolm X and the possible role in the assassination, I endeavored to engage one or more in oral history interviews. In 2004, after several months of negotiation, Thomas Johnson agreed to sit down for a 3.5-hour interview in a small apartment in Harlem. In prison, Johnson had converted to Orthodox Islam, and he met me cordially. I first asked Johnson to reconstruct his working relationship with Malcolm when they were both members of the Nation. Johnson explained that he had worked as a bodyguard and chauffeur to Malcolm for several years in the early 60s. On a monthly basis for several years, Johnson had shopped in a Queens grocery store, picking up groceries and other items for Malcolm's family and delivering them to his kitchen. When Malcolm X was scheduled to arrive at the Harlem Mosque No. 7, Johnson was the person assigned to stand in the middle of the street, regardless of the weather, to preserve a parking space for Malcolm's blue Oldsmobile as Malcolm drove up. Johnson expressed continued admiration and respect for the Muslim minister, But in his oral testimony, he made no effort to conceal his anger at Malcolm's 64 break from the nation. Johnson revealed that he had taken part in an abortive plan to murder Malcolm X in Philadelphia several months prior to the latter's assassination. Had Elijah Muhammad ordered Johnson to kill Malcolm on February 21, 1965, Johnson asserted, he unquestionably would have done so. Given that Johnson was widely known personally by Malcolm, by Malcolm's wife, Betty X, later Betty Shabazz, and all of his lieutenants, it's impossible to believe that he entered the Audubon Ballroom that day. Johnson's compelling oral testimony, as well as FBI internal memos that we have discovered, indicating that none of the initial physical descriptions of the shooters that the FBI has received in their airtails matched Johnson, convincingly indicate that he did not participate in this assassination. Nevertheless, he was convicted and given a life sentence by the DA. The most revealing oral interviews, and I have to wrap up, but I just want to raise two more very briefly, were with Louis Farrakhan and Ossie Davis. After 3 years' effort, I finally got to sit down with the NOI leader in May 2004 in a Chicago home for an extraordinary 9-hour interview. I met again with Farrakhan for a follow-up interview in May 2005. Farrakhan provided personal details about living in Malcolm X's home in the mid-50s, Malcolm's personal mentorship of him as Farrakhan rose in the Nation of Islam's hierarchy. Farrakhan was the key lieutenant of Malcolm X. It was through Malcolm's support and aegis that Farrakhan became, then he was Louis X, he became the minister of the mosque in Boston. In 63, when Malcolm had learned about Elijah Muhammad's sexual infidelities and out-of-wedlock children, it was to Louis X, to Farrakhan, that Malcolm sought out advice. Farrakhan remained loyal to Muhammad in 64, and he bitterly denounced at the time his former mentor, Malcolm X, as, quote, a man worthy of death. But in our interviews, Farrakhan expressed deep regret about his inflammatory rhetoric at that time, which he concedes openly contributed to his friend's murder. In many ways, the most remarkable oral history interviews were with the late actor Ossie Davis in 2003, shortly before his death. Ossie explained in great detail the evolution of his close friendship with Malcolm, which began in 60. Malcolm admired Davis's play, Pearly Victorious, and despite the NOI's strict restrictions placed against their members, attending plays also attended by whites, Malcolm came to the Broadway show. A close association followed, especially after Malcolm broke from the NOI. In his interview, Davis described Malcolm's visit to his home only days before the assassination. Davis described an emotionally and mentally exhausted, a drained man who recognized that his death was inescapable. His home had only been firebombed several days before. Davis recounted how, in a matter of a few minutes, he had written Malcolm's eulogy at the dining room table, which he read at Malcolm's funeral. I asked Davis why he used the memorable phrase that Malcolm was and remains and will be our black shining prince to describe Malcolm in the eulogy. And Ossie explained that a dead prince can never become a king. Malcolm's greatness is found in what he might have been. Malcolm El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz was no saint. Yet, despite his contradictions and other personal challenges and failings, Malcolm possessed also the unique potential for uniting black Americans in an unprecedented coalition with African, Asian, and Caribbean nations. He alone arguably, he alone could have established a unity between Negro integrationists and black nationalists inside the United States. He possessed the personal charisma, the rhetorical genius, and the moral courage to inspire and motivate millions of blacks into united action. Neither the autobiography nor Spike Lee's 1992 movie revealed this powerful legacy of the man or explained what he could have accomplished. What continues to be suppressed and censored, and by that I mean the over 20,000 pages of FBI surveillance that is still not available to the public about Malcolm X, also tells us something so huge about America itself, about where we were then and where we are as a people now. Malcolm X was potentially a new type of world leader, personally drawn from the wretched of the earth into a political stratosphere of international power. Telling that remarkable true story is the purpose of my biography. Thank you.